From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Mutlu Siviroglu, senior broadcaster with VOA's Kurdish service. Our topic on this edition of the program, roots and implications of violent protests in Iraq and the impact of the U.S. withdrawal of troops from northern Syria, paving the way for a Turkish incursion, upsetting the region's strategic alliances and sparking a possible resurgence of Daesh, or the so-called Islamic State. Our guest, Abbas Kadim. He is resident senior fellow and director of the Iraq Initiative at the Atlantic Council, and that's a prominent think tank here in Washington. Abbas Kadim is an Iraq expert and author of Reclaiming Iraq, the 1920 Revolution and the Founding of the Modern State. His research focuses on Iraq, Iran, the Persian Gulf, and Islam. Abbas was formerly an assistant professor of security affairs and Middle East studies at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and a visiting professor at Stanford University. He also served at the Iraqi embassy in Washington. We look forward to getting his insights on the recent unrest in Iraq and what it means for the future of the country and region. Protests over corruption, widespread unemployment, and the government's inability to provide basic services have rocked the country since early October. The first 2 days of October saw thousands of protesters taking to the streets in Baghdad and throughout many other cities and towns in the country. Many of the protests have grown violent, with several thousand wounded and over 100 dead. Security forces responded to the protests with tear gas and rubber bullets, but in some cases, live ammunition. Tensions mounted as the Iraqi government sought to enforce a curfew in a struggle to restore stability. The government also shut down access to the internet, a tactic favored by regimes across the region attempting to gain control over the population. While Iraq's young population faces massive unemployment, the country as a whole remains plagued by a stagnant economy and hobbled by egregious levels of graft and corruption. Only a year into his tenure, the government of Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi is facing intense pressure as the Iraqi central government attempts to lead a fractured country. We'll discuss it all, including the impact of the Turkish incursion into Syria, with Abbas Kadim, who joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague from the Kurdish service, Mutlu Siviroglu.
Thank you, Carol.
Abbas Kadim, let's talk about the roots of these protests. You were just there in Iraq. I'd like to know what you see and heard and how you characterize the protests. To what extent do they differ from previous protests that we've seen in Iraq?
Thank you for having me. The protests were no different than the previous ones. There is a sporadic eruption of protests every once in a while in Iraq. Mostly there is some spark that triggers protests, but once they happen and people are on the streets, you will see the whole list of grievances being put forward, and these are grievances that have been accumulating since maybe 2003, or even one can go as back as the 1980s. Iraq was neglected for a number of decades. This time, the spark was the removal of General Abdel Wahab al-Sa'idi from the counterterrorism service. He's a war hero, a national hero for his fight against ISIS, and he was the one who fought with valor among other generals, but his name and face was more familiar to everyone as he was leading an elite force. And his removal, he was sent to a desk job at the Ministry of Defense, triggered some objections, and he did not help the situation by coming on the media and criticizing the decision, announcing earlier that he would not comply. Then he complied, but by the time he decided to comply, the problems of the protests was already out, and as I said, people were on the streets, and the protests took a life of their own matters that were not much related to Abdul Wahab Saadi's removal. And I was on the ground at the time, stayed for 2 to 5 days while the protests were happening. And I saw the protests in a couple of cities in Baghdad and in Najaf province. The protests were pretty much the same, limited to certain areas where the protests take place, Tahrir Square in Baghdad and several other locations, and also in Najaf to the 1920 Revolution Square in Najaf and in several residential quarters. But the rest of the cities were quiet. Life is business as usual. There was a curfew, but it was not fully enforced. You could just talk to the police and to the checkpoints, and they will let you go. Travelers to airports or hospitals were not included in the curfew. In any way, it was an unfortunate occurrence, as Iraq has been moving steadfastly towards a better life, more normal life, especially in Baghdad. Security was improving recently. But again, these are things that erupt once in a while and then they calm down. And we still have to wait for the 25th of October when the big protests are being planned for and announced.
Let me ask you a quick follow-up before I turn to Mutlu, my colleague. Some say there's a generational divide, and the protesters are primarily from the Shia ethnic group. I want to know about the significance of that versus the Sunni or the Kurds. And they're very young. You know, they're looking for employment, and they're seeing the wealth of the country, the oil wealth, but they don't see it as benefiting them. And it's only been a year since, of course, the new government came to power. But they're saying, you know, where are the results? Don't they have a point?
They do. And as I mentioned earlier, these are not protests against the current government, but more of an accumulation of problems that happened throughout the past 15 years or so. And whenever protests erupt, they erupt in the face of whoever is the prime minister at the time. But yes, the generational issue is very important. 50% of Iraqis are under 19 years old. These are people who have no personal memory of the previous regime of Saddam Hussein's era. They grew up in the current era of democratization, and they would like to see their lives moving in a significant way towards the better. There doesn't seem to be a strong indication in that way. It is very important to pay attention to the demographic makeup of the protesters, even though Iraqis are moving a little bit away from the old sectarian divide and ethno-sectarian fault lines. But still, it is very significant that the Shia population is taking the streets, because the government, for good or bad, is led by the Shia major parties, and they are having more clout and more say in the ultimate decision-making in the country. The prime minister is a Shia. And when the Shia are the ones who are protesting, the challenge to the authority of the regime and on the government and on the leading parties is more serious, because here you cannot cite sectarianism, you cannot cite ethnicism. You really have to deal with the reality that these are people with legitimate concerns and legitimate grievances, and they have no motivations other than the true grievances that they have.
And they seem to represent the similar grievances of the Sunni and the Kurdish population.
Yes.
Let me now turn to my colleague Mutlu Siveroglu for an observation or a question.
Thank you, Abbas. I would like to know what has calmed the protesters down. How significant were the calls from the Shia religious leaders? Also, coming back to the beginning of your comment, why was the general sacked from his position if he's even Kurds like him? I know from the Kurdish perspective, they speak highly of him. So what was the reason to take him from his position?
Well, he was taken out of his position because of apparently what I've been hearing from behind the scenes is that there are some disputes among the top generals in the counterterrorism services, and that is one of the reasons. There is also a political competition over positions like this among the various groups, and each one would like to bring a general close to them now that the fight is over. And this position does not need a general with valor, but a general who is more complacent with this party or that. And I think it's really an internal military competition, and also it's a political wrangling and rivalry around that. As to your question on why the protests stopped, there has been a credible effort among the leadership of Iraq, the prime minister, the president of the country, and also the speaker of the parliament. All of them went out and spoke to the people and made serious promises. And also they introduced packages of economic reforms. Some jobs were involved in promise making. But we should not also think that this is over, because there is, again, a major protest being planned for on the 25th of October. What helped the government also that nowadays Iraq is witnessing this annual pilgrimage to Karbala, where up to 15 million people go and participate in that commemoration of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the Prophet Muhammad's grandson. And that takes people, mostly the young people who can walk on foot for all of these kilometers of the streets. So the protesters want to ensure bigger show up and bigger numbers for the protests. And that's why they delayed it to after what's called Arba'iniya, the 40th day anniversary of the martyrdom.
Abbas Kadim, do you think that the Iraqi Prime Minister's response to provide greater training and educational initiatives for unemployed youth, housing, and so forth, will that be enough to mollify them? Because it seems that they are also demanding in their protests a removal of the entire political class. They are just fed up with the corruption in particular.
The promises are more of really a local anesthesia, if you will. It is going to make the pain go away for a moment, then it comes back. What the Iraqi leadership needs is to think hard about long-term solutions, things that can make things better, and as a strategic solution to the economic issues, to the political problem, to corruption, to the controlled bureaucracy in the country. And that is very important. Yes, they might help calm the streets, and certain people would probably see them as a good start. But also, let's remember that sometimes these same promises can be politicized, and you know, there are people who would say, well, if you can do these things, why didn't you do them until hundreds of thousands took to the streets rather than, you know, so that could be also turned against the government by people who are more politically motivated to challenge the government. But I think what Iraq needs is more of a strategy than just tactics that will calm the streets every time there is an eruption, because that's not going to be helpful for the entire regime. As to why the people are calling for the collapse of the regime or the change of the regime, unlike what used to be the reform of the regime, that could be read as a tactic to raise the ceiling of the demands and maybe make the political class, their entire existence and power is at stake. They will start to work harder and give more in order to have the people accept them again. And it is just a negotiation between the protesters and the government, and the results of it will be seen in the coming weeks.
Quickly, before we go to a break, what do you make of the slogans of the protesters calling on Iran to get out? Now, we know Iran is there, has an important presence, sometimes good, but sometimes negative. How do you see that expression?
Iraqis have mixed feelings about the Iranians. On the one hand, they understand that Iran is a reality with a 1,400 kilometers next to Iraq. It's historically been there. There are so many affinities between the two peoples, religious and cultural, etc. There is also somewhere around $12 billion of trade exchange. Most of it is Iranian sales to the Iraqis. Iraqis depend on Iran for the food they eat, for many of their goods that they buy, and also, most importantly, the energy and electricity. Much of Iraq's electricity is directly imported from Iran, and the fuel for the electricity that Iraq produces comes also from Iran. But on the other hand, Iraqis also do feel rightfully that Iran does play a role to influence the internal affairs of Iraq in a very negative way. There is too much meddling of Iran into Iraqi affairs to the point where it cannot be sustained. Iran needs to respect the internal affairs of Iraq and reduce its meddling as much as possible. And in fact, we are talking about a lot of reduction that needs to happen.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest is Abbas Kadim. He's resident senior fellow and director of the Iraq Initiative at the Atlantic Council, and that's a prominent think tank here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with senior broadcaster in VOA's Kurdish service, Mutlu Siviroglu. Here's a shout-out to Manu Hirallal from Colombo, Sri Lanka. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to our special guest, Abbas Kadim. Quickly before I turn to my colleague Mutlu, what about Iran's influence vis-a-vis militias, the popular mobilization units, and to what extent are they responsible perhaps for some of the excessive violence that was perceived to have been used on the protesters? We have over 100 dead, more than 1,000 wounded. What about the hand of Iran or its militias?
Some of the armed forces that are acting in Iraq, mostly they were coming into being after ISIS took over one-third of Iraqi territory back in June of 2014, and their existence was tolerated, and Iran's help to them and to Iraq was appreciated while the fight was going. But many of these groups had two wings, one wing that fought the so-called Islamic State and another wing that was inside the Iraqi provinces and cities doing work that Iraqis don't approve of, a lot of blackmail, a lot of even criminality, etc. And not, of course, all of the popular mobilization is of that nature, only a few groups that might fit this description. Now that the fight against ISIS is over, there are many Iraqis who would like to see arms under the control of the state, and they want to see a successful solution to the problem of arms that are outside the control of the Iraqi state. There hasn't been any strong evidence that was presented that would implicate the popular mobilization units in directly shooting the protesters. But there is a committee to investigate what happened, and they are supposed to present their findings in a very expedited way. The Marja'iyya, the Iraqi Shia Authority in Najaf, gave the government 2 weeks to give that results, and they should be presenting that before October 25th. That will tell us the definite answer whether they were implicated or not, and that is important. One thing probably, if we were to speculate, we don't see any reason for Iran to shoot unarmed protesters, knowing that it will discredit the prime minister in charge right now, who is a very strong ally of Iran and very close to them. Iran does not have a stake to topple Adel Abdel Mahdi's government.
Now I'd like to turn to another crisis in the region. One might say a U.S.-created crisis. Mr. Trump spoke recently with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, basically saying that he agreed to withdraw 1,000 U.S. troops from northern Syria, in effect abandoning our Kurdish allies in the Syrian Democratic Forces to make the way for a Turkish incursion into northeastern Syria, because to President Erdogan, the SDF, who have been critical in routing Daesh or ISIS, are seen as terrorists by Ankara because of links to the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. So I want to turn to my colleague Mutlu, who has a hand on what's going on in the region. And tell us, Mutlu, what do you see happening on the ground, the implications for the Kurds? And we'll talk about that spillover into Iraq after that.
Kurds have found themselves in a very difficult situation because now they have been left to the mercy of Bashar Assad, Putin.
And Russia's President Putin.
Yes, Russia's President Putin. And they are running from President Erdogan of Turkey. So the options are really very bad. But they, at this dire situation, they think Bashar Assad is the lesser of the evils. That's why they had to make a deal with him. So President Trump, on one hand, he's claiming to put an end to wars, but on the other hand, things are unfolding very risky, more conflict, more war. It's been turning to a chaotic environment. As of now, close to 300,000 people are displaced, according to the Kurdish officials. So people have nowhere to run away because normally Kurdish cities are on the borderline, but borderline are the front line. I know many people, some of my relatives, they are sleeping out at night and open because they have nowhere to go. So the situation is very bad. Abbas fortunately mentioned in Iraq that ISIS issue is under control, but Syria was still there. Pockets. Now there is a very serious threat of reemergence of ISIS. Already some of their foreigner members fled. Sleeper cells are activated. So I think very messy things are unfolding, and it's going to get worse unless international community steps in.
And of course, our Kurdish allies were guarding the prisons where many of these ISIS fighters were being held, and then there are camps. So I'd like to get your view, Abbas Kadim, on this decision by President Trump, which has been condemned by many of our own lawmakers and others in the U.S. government, as well as, of course, our allies, the Kurds, and others in the international community. And yet we're dealing with a NATO ally. I mean, how do you see this incredible turn of events and the impact on the region?
Well, the U.S. involvement in Syria has been incoherent all along, and it's not just this administration. It has been cross administrations. On the one hand, we could not secure a very good arrangement to have with the active powers, the Syrian government that has the legal saying on who gets involved and who doesn't. We did not work with them because they are on the other side. The Turks also have been using the Syria and other cases of really negotiationships with the United States, even though they are a NATO ally. But most of their action is not much of an ally's action. And also the other active players in Syria are quite on the opposite side of the instance, whether it is Iran or other forces close to it, or the Russians, who are the U.S.'s main competitors throughout the world. So it is an envious position, and it is where we are at. I don't think that the president's decision by itself made it worse or better, because the Turks seemed to be going to enter with or without our approval. So one might argue that pulling those troops actually took them out of harm's way. But on the other hand, there is also a legitimate concern that maybe having those troops would serve as a deterrence to the forces on the ground not to abuse or violate the human rights of the population, Kurds and others as well. It's not only Kurds, but there are Arabs, there are Christians, there are others. From an Iraqi perspective, I think this is very important for the Iraqis. The Iraqis tried always to advocate for a political solution in Syria and nonviolent solution. Their biggest concern has to do with the resurgence or possibility of the resurgence of ISIS, whether it is by way of ISIS penetrating the borders towards Iraq, fleeing the conflict, or taking advantage of the chaos that happens from the current incursion from Turkey to regroup and act under the umbrella of that situation. There is also a concern from Iraq regarding the people who have to leave, the IDPs. Iraq has until now somewhere around 1.8 million, some say 1.5 million IDPs of their own. And this will for sure create many more IDPs, whether they are living in the open inside Syria or later on, maybe a safe passage will be made for them. Where are they going to go? It's going to be Iraq. Not to mention all of the people who are, you know, there are reports of people who are fleeing jails who have been associated with ISIS, their families or suspected ISIS members. The current situation is very dangerous on many fronts, and I don't think that it serves the national interests of the United States, not to mention the humanitarian catastrophe that is happening out of it, which is normally in these conflicts, the little guy is always going to be hurt most.
Abbas, I want to ask your view about reemergence of ISIS, the STF, the Kurdish state. You also mentioned there are significant amount of Arabs, Syria, Christians, Yazidis. Now that STF is in this position and President Trump believes Turkey is going to be able to fight with ISIS, how realistic is this?
I don't think the Turks are interested in fighting ISIS. They have not been interested in fighting ISIS in Iraq. A lot of the help that got to ISIS was actually coming through Turkey, and whether it is by looking the other way or, you know, we cannot tell, but it is a fact that much of what ISIS was getting was coming through Turkey. Turkey is most concerned regarding its own borders and fighting what it sees as terrorist groups, and that's the PKK and anything that is close to it. Unless ISIS threatens Turkey directly, I don't see Turkey seeing ISIS as a problem of their own, because that's not what their past behavior, at least.
Now, with the withdrawal of U.S. troops, air support, we have basically ceded the ground to President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, of course, Russia, and by extension, Iran. So many are scratching their heads here in the United States and around the world wondering, you know, why would the United States do that? because it weakens our leverage. We've abandoned the Kurds. It can only weaken U.S. leverage in the region and demonstrate that the U.S. can abandon an ally at the drop of a hat. What's your take on how this is going to affect Iraqi-U.S. relations?
It's amazing. I think this idea that the United States doesn't abandon their allies is believed more in the United States. People on the receiving end of that policy have long realized this, whether it's the Iraqis in 1991, the Kurds in several occasions, and also other allies have been receiving that kind of treatment. But I think that the problem of it is that those who criticize the president must also factor in U.S. domestic politics. This is not a pure international relations or foreign policy or on the part of the president. What we have here is a president who is moving very fast towards an election. He wants to secure a second term, and he does not want to open himself to any catastrophe that can happen in Syria. So he is acting more conservatively than normally U.S. presidents do to avoid any kind of a surprise in the middle of the election season. He'd rather be criticized on abandoning Syria by fulfilling a promise that his constituents always wanted. He was elected for criticizing all of these wars that he called endless wars and on promising that he would pull the troops and all of that. So I think he's playing to a constituency that is very sympathetic to his decisions and trying to be risk averse. And then the soundness or the right or wrong of the decision as a foreign policy is taking a backseat.
But even President Trump's significant names in his party criticize the decision. They refer back to President Obama's premature departure from Iraq, which later on caused emergence of ISIS and other insurgency. For example, in the recent days, his own party, President Trump's own party, is supporting bipartisan efforts to reverse his decision. So hasn't it already caused some problem in his own base?
It is causing problems in his political base, but not electorate base. I think that the president is calculating this in terms of votes rather than political support. He knows that Congress right now is not his priority. Yes, it will hurt him if this will be linked to his legislative agenda. But I think the president right now is more interested in how it plays in the Midwest, how it plays in the South. Again, that's not to say the president is right or wrong. This is the way that he and his strategists think, and they believe that among the options that they have, this is the option that will cost him less in terms of counting votes and facing the electorate, because this is going to be consistent with what Trump campaign was and his presidency. And there is also, again, in terms of the final analysis, is this unpredictable nature of President Trump, who, you know, maybe tomorrow he will start to send troops. Nobody knows.
I think that's a very good point. And Abbas, as we close, let's go back to Iraq. You might want to conclude with the protests and to what extent you think they could die down and things could quiet down.
Well, I think that we are clearly right now in the dark on what could happen in the next step. Right now, there is the calm that precedes the what could be a nasty storm on the 25th of October, or maybe 25th of October will come and the government has managed to give the people another reason not to play a zero-sum game with a massive demonstration that might lead to catastrophic results. I think that right now, if I were in the position of the Iraqi government, I would treat these 7 or 8 days between the demonstrations and what happened in the past as critical days, as probably existential time frame that the government can live or die on the basis of how the behavior will be understood. I think the Iraqis, both the populace and the government, need to see themselves as partners in making this ship safe or sail in a way that is very safe to the next shore, because if Iraq goes into the abyss of catastrophic violence, every Iraqi government and population will be losers. And there is a hope. The trajectory of the country has been going really in a good direction. It is a shame that the Iraqis, all walks of life and government and the population, don't seem to appreciate the opportunities that they have and their duty as citizens and leaders to do best by Iraq.
Abbas Kadim is resident senior fellow and director of the Iraq Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Abbas, thank you for your time and terrific insights on Iraq and the region.
Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And joining me on the program was Mutlu Siviroglu. He's senior broadcaster with VOA's Kurdish service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.